Are you an insider? Subscribe to FC Insiders today to receive full, unedited interviews, news, rumors, exclusive content, and more. Join FC Insiders at futurecommerce.fm.
Future Commerce is brought to you by PayPal. Did you realize that mobile shoppers spend 39% more time but less money on commerce websites compared to their desktop counterparts? There's a significant opportunity to improve mobile conversion rates while delivering a better buying experience. That is why PayPal has collaborated with 15 Magento system integrators and High Conversion to uncover what changes help and hurt the mobile checkout experience. For details on the program, learnings to date, and how to get involved, visit mobileoptimize.org today.
Future Commerce is brought to you by Vertex. Vertex is the leader of tax technology solutions and services for corporations worldwide. They're trusted by over half of the Fortune 500. Vertex Cloud meets sales and use tax solutions for businesses of all kinds. Visit them online today at vertexsmb.com. Emarsys is the largest independent marketing platform company in the world. Their software enables truly personalized one-to-one interactions between marketers and customers across all channels. They help you build loyalty and enrich the customer journey while increasing your revenue. Go to emarsys.com/futurecommerce to request a demo and see for yourself how Emarsys can help your company scale marketing decisions. That's Emarsys, emarsys.com/futurecommerce.
Welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about next generation commerce. I'm Brian.
And I'm Philip.
And today we have Steve Conine, co-founder of Wayfair, with us. Thanks for coming on the show, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Really excited to talk with you. We've got a lot of stuff to cover today, so let's just jump right in. To kick things off, introduce yourself. You know, who are you? What's your story? How did you get started with Wayfair?
Sure.
Give us the rundown. Yeah.
Sure. So, I'm Steve Conine. I'm one of the co-founders of Wayfair. So we started this business back in 2002 in my house here in Boston. Neerj Shah and myself. So Neerj and I were fellow Cornellians, and we've started three businesses together in our career. So I've been an entrepreneur since I graduated. This business we got into in 2002 when, I would say e-commerce wasn't exactly the hot investment area. And I think, we saw that as the opportunity. Every year, the U.S. Commerce Department would release statistics showing that more and more people were purchasing online. So even though I think a lot of people in the late 90s saw sort of the euphoria of the internet and thought that the transitions to online shopping would happen a lot faster, I think the pace of consumers moving online, while it might have been a little slower than what people had initially thought, it was absolutely happening. And we saw that as a great opportunity and felt like, the e-commerce space was sort of a ripe area to jump into.
And you made the right bet, right?
Yes, worked out, right. Well, so, when you get into this market, I previously ran a consulting business. It was the first company Neerj and I started, and the second one was in the software space, in the mobile phone space. And this is a category, in those businesses, you could kind of like mark, the market landscape for who you could sell to was small. And you could kind of figure out, okay, at some point, these are the companies we're selling to, and, there's only a limited number of them. When you get into e-commerce, the exciting thing, I think, when we got into this business was that it's, two-thirds of the GDP is consumer spending. So it's a limitless market. And so you're really only held up, in terms of your aspirations for how large your company can get or the opportunity. It's really, limited by just your ambition. And so I think when we got into this, that was very exciting for us to sort of be in a market where there's a huge, potential to become a very, very large business.
Yeah, that's
large business is a bit of an understatement. I think, Wayfair is recognized as, an obvious like global scale brand and has a lot of dominance in the marketplace. And you also have several brands that you guys carry and that you manage yourself. But, I have this very interesting outlook in kind of wondering who is your customer today and how has that kind of changed in the past 5 years for you?
Yeah. So our customer today is sort of a 45 to 55 year old woman. we always describe it as, you know, people don't purchase a lot of the goods that we sell until they've sort of started to settle down and, you know, and a lot of times raise a family, or, you know, they're purchasing a home or renting a larger place. And so, you know, the younger generation, so the millennial generation today is just in their early 30s. They're obviously purchasing a tremendous amount online, but they only dabble in our categories. And, you know, the reason is it's really driven by their life and where they are in kind of the stages of their life. So our core customers, you know, they're later in their life, and it's basically been that way since we've got into this business. I think, one of the things that's created the opportunity for us in the categories that we're in is that it is a different category. It has a different shopper, and it has a lot of different use cases and ways that you know customers think about it, in their lives.
Do you think that your customer has changed or tracked along with you in the last, 5 years, or how will they change in the next 5 years that you're planning for? Like the consumer changes, does that change in like age range, or is there a broader market? Or I know you guys have a huge marketplace component. Is your customer also more B2B centric these days? I'm curious, how you see that changing.
Yeah. So, I don't know that there's a dramatic change you'll see. I mean, we are very maniacally focused on being the best solution for shopping for the home online. And so I think, if you look at home purchasing, it's the demographic of who's purchasing that. I don't think there's something that all of a sudden says, 20-year-olds are going to start purchasing it and, a lot of home furniture. You know, they tend to inherit it, or they tend to be moving into places that are previously furnished. Yeah, I think you referenced B2B. Our primary business is direct-to-consumer. We definitely have a nice B2B portion of our business, and I think that'll continue to grow, and we're certainly focused on servicing that customer base. I think on a broad demographic level, one of the things we're very excited about is that the millennial generation, who I think a lot of ways, like, they've driven the online adoption of streaming media, or they've really driven a lot of apparel and some of the sort of earlier categories that you purchase younger in life. They are super comfortable shopping online. They basically turn to it as kind of their, initial whatever, option of where to shop. As they start to age in, they're just turning 37, I think, by the way they sort of define that group. As they start to age into our core demographic, we're very excited that we have an offering that is spot on for them. It feels young, it feels exciting, it's well merchandised, and we're providing a spectrum of things that will hopefully they'll find very interesting.
That makes sense, and I think one of the things that I've seen that you've done very well is you've kind of created your own brands as well. You're sort of your house brand. So you're well recognized as a marketplace, but you've also built out kind of a staple of house brands. And it's interesting because Amazon has come under a lot of fire for some of their sort of their house brands, if you will, their generics. But I don't see Wayfair coming under that same scrutiny. And I feel like it's because you've approached it completely differently than Amazon. How would you say that your go-to-market strategy is with these exclusives, and how do you see using the concept of a brand in the future?
The first thing is the category one is very different. So, if you take a highly branded category, so if you're selling, say, Duracell AA batteries or Energizer batteries, I mean, there's a basic AA size that fits in all the devices, and they all try to position, they're from brands different ways. In our world, there are no brands. Like, if you think of home brands and you ask consumers, name a few brands of home, they will name retail brands. And so they don't actually name the underlying manufacturer of the products, with very few exceptions. In our space, you get into some of the housewares category. So KitchenAid would be a brand people would say. But when you get into, bedroom or dining room or kitchen or bath or rugs, or people don't have brands in mind. They'll come up with the name of where they bought it, right? And so one of the things that's really that lets us do, or that we have done, is we try to help the consumer make sense of the space by creating sub brands, and we call them exclusive brands or house brands, within the portfolio of products that we sell. And so we buy from manufacturers. We might buy from a manufacturer who just makes wooden seating. We buy from another one who just makes, maybe like wooden tables. Another one makes just rugs. Another one makes throw pillows. Another one makes upholstery. Well, the consumer doesn't want to think about, you've got a dozen different brands, and I got to pick a flooring guy, and then I got to pick a chair guy, and then they want to think of it as a collection. So we will have a collection you know, Lark Manor is one of our collections, or Braden Home, or Grayley, where we curate across the industry all the different pieces together, and we put them together into a consistent style, consistent look, oftentimes similar price band, makes it easier for the customer to shop. And the manufacturers love it because, you know, they don't have brands to begin with. They're used to having merchants come in and curate looks for their store. So, you know, if you shopped at a Pottery Barn or a Crate and Barrel, Restoration Hardware, similar type, you know, scenario where you're going in, they've pre-curated looks for you. They're buying across the industry. The industry behind it doesn't have brands. So our world is a very different landscape than what you find in core commodity. And the way it's merchandised and the way it's brought to light for the customer, you know, we're just playing into that.
Interesting. So you're saying that the category of home in particular sort of lends itself to this strategy more than other categories do.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very unbranded category, right? You could think of it like apparel would be another category that sometimes, you know, we reference to say, well, it's similar in that there's a massive selection bias and people want to have different stuff from each other. They want to have their clothes look, you know, have their own, you know, it sort of be a representation of themselves. Home is very much that way, but home doesn't have brands. You know, there's not a Nike and Adidas or, you know, Jimmy Choo of home. The brands in home are the brands that the retailers have made up.
Right.
With the exception, again, you know, there's some high-end brands here and there that maybe have some awareness, but their awareness is tiny compared to what you'd find in, you know, again, core commodity. You think about Duracell, you think about Energizer, you think about Bounty paper towels. You know, those are all things where they've put a lot of money behind marketing, creating a brand. The manufacturer has. They then merchandise it. You know, they send it out to the retailers who merchandise on the shelves. Our category is very different.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's interesting. I think it's actually been even in like grocery and you know, even in the CPG market, you're starting to see this idea of brandless be a bigger and bigger idea. Like people actually are a lot less brand dependent and brand loyal. So I actually really, I love this. This is really interesting.
Yeah. I'm always very surprised at the number of people who aren't really sure what brand of X, Y, or Z that they buy from Whole Foods. They just know that they like Whole Foods. And I think that's like an evolution of the consumer because, yeah, the days gone by, I do think that there was a lot of brand loyalty, especially in CPG. I would make the argument, you know, not to pet anyone's ego, maybe Wayfair is the Nike or the Jimmy Choo in that you're creating the brand engagement and they're buying an experience or, you know, and that's, you know, that's effectively what Zappos would have been credited with doing in a bygone era. But I think that's more what the consumer is looking for these days, especially in digital commerce. It's more about that sort of experience. It's more aggregation, merchandising, taste making. It's more about buying buying in a world that's focused on, selling toward me by my tastes. So, you know, commercializing like a Pinterest or an Instagram, which, you know, I can just live in this world that is created for me. You're anticipating, you know, categories and trends in a way that, you know, appeals towards those types of consumers. It fits very squarely within the world that they already live in elsewhere.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think when you look at like what brands do, you know, they basically, you know, they give consumers confidence of a consistency of experience, right? Imagine, you know, pick your favorite, you know, soft drink brand. Well, imagine if every fifth can made you violently ill. Like your fee for the brand would not be that high, right? So the reason you trust it is that, you know, you have, you know, hundreds of friends, you've drank, you know, plenty of it. It's always delivered a very consistent experience that you come to trust, right? So the new brand that shows up in the market you've never heard of, well, you know, you might move into it a little, you know, skittishly, or if someone else is endorsing it, you move into it, you know, a little more aggressively. But I think you're right. Like, you know, in our marketplace, we basically, you know, have tried to build a durable experience where customers over time come to feel like, oh, great, you know, Wayfair delivers products quickly. They have great selection. The quality of the items are good. You know, they basically have taken on the burden of vetting out what is, you know, going to be a good product for me. And so I don't have to think about it as much. And, you know, that's what I think creates brand affinity, brand loyalty.
And obviously this has paid off for you. You had an unbelievable Q2. And I know that Q3 isn't quite released yet. But I mean, I just, we'll brag on you for a minute. You're, direct net revenue was increased $538 million up to $1.6 billion, up 48.8% year over year, which is just amazing. Gross profit $385 million or 23.3% of total net revenue. Just unprecedented success online. It's really powerful. And you know, strategies like the ones you've implemented are helping you achieve this level of success. I think another thing that's really helping you achieve success is you're widely considered one of the most successful innovators in commerce. So tell us, what's your secret here?
the core of it is our team. We have an amazing team. We put a huge amount of effort into trying to find and hire the, you know, best people in market. And then I think, you know, probably as important, we try to, you know, make sure we have a culture and that lets them work to their full potential. And I think when particularly when you look at innovation, I think innovation only happens when you have sort of the right blend of a space where you can hire, you know, creative people and they feel like they have the, you know, space to take risks without huge downsides. If you look at what we do, whether it's in engineering or whether it's with a merchandiser or in marketing or the way, you know, we've approached TV advertising, we try to create a culture and environment where we can test stuff. We can try things that may be obvious. We can try things that may not be obvious. We can learn, we can feed that back in and do it a little bit better the next day. And I think, you know, if you look at this business and you say, well, it's taking 16 years to get to where you are, it doesn't sound quite as, you know, crazy. If you think about every day, our team comes in here and tries to figure out how do we make the experience from yesterday a little bit better tomorrow. And that compounding over years gets to where you have a, you know, very exciting, very durable experience that customers start to say, oh, wow, trust and a value.
I think that that's spot on. One of the things that I've seen that that sort of took me by surprise. So I come from an engineering background and, you know, 10 years ago I was building e-commerce sites. And, you know, back then it was the build versus buy conversation wasn't so prevalent as you see today. A lot of people are buying more than they're building these days. But, you know, I come from a custom software background. So I always sit up and take notice when a retailer or someone in the merchant space is contributing back to an engineering, as an engineering organization, to larger engineering efforts. And that's something that I've equated with Wayfair for a very long time. I think of other brands that are having resurgence, like Walmart, who are doing the same, and other brands that are in other ancillary, say, like payment technology space, like PayPal, who are doing the same. And I have to believe that it hints at a culture of innovation and trust in an engineering organization. And I think that that's something that, while it's not necessarily a key to success, it is a symptom of success in that you have a forward-thinking culture that likes to not only publicize the kind of work and effort and the engineering culture, and bring others, make that an attractive place for others to come contribute their efforts to, but also that you're innovating and you're pushing forward, and that you're doing it even at the smallest levels of your engineering organization. I think that bodes really well as a retailer who sees yourself as an innovator, that you're not just consumers, but you're creators.
Yeah, no, I think it's quite liberating from a technology innovation standpoint to actually not be in the business of selling software. So, you know, we're in the business of obviously using technology to create an experience for customers. We look at it very differently. I mean, you referenced the way we give back to the community and the way we sort of, think about, exposing what we're doing publicly to anyone. It's a fun space to be in, as I think, as an innovator and, you know, an engineer working on our team.
And awesome. I think that sort of, you know, that's turned into larger efforts, right? So, you know, one of the things we hear, especially around, retail innovation and the focus of our podcast, is things like AI, machine learning, machine vision. And when I think of those things in the context of Wayfair, I think of it as, you know, strategies that aren't, you know, technologies in search of a solution, but strategies that are employed to sort of skate to where the puck's going to be, if you will. So you're working on a bunch of these innovative things. I think of you as the leader, but how would you, to people who aren't aware of the kinds of tech innovation that you're investing in right now, could you give us a little bit of a rundown of the things that you think are going to be differential for you in over the medium term?
Sure. So, well, you know, you sort of hit on a few. So I think, you know, AI and machine learning are both, spaces that we have fairly large teams going after. You know, I think the easier side to think about is probably from the consumer experience. So if you think about, you know, our customers, a lot of times are trying to find products that are right for their home or right for their style or right for their look. We have this, you know, we think is one of the largest data sets of information about how people browse for their home and how they shop for their home and how they research products. And so, you know, we basically have a team of data scientists that are trying to figure out how do we enhance that. So, you know, there's obvious things like how do we send them the right email and how do we highlight things in marketing programs that are things that are going to be exciting to customers. When they're on our site and we're showing them search results, how do we dynamically try to put products that we think are going to be, you know, more interesting to customers in front of them quicker so that the sort of overwhelming size of our catalog doesn't become a deterrent and we can actually get, you know, stuff in front of people quicker. How do we use, you know, imagery? This is a very visual category. A lot of times people can take a picture of something that they like, but they don't know really how to describe it. So can we take, you know, visual imagery and use machine vision to turn that into, you know, search results that can help customers navigate the space very quickly. So that's a whole domain we invest a tremendous amount in. You know, I think it's from the outside, you just look at customers would say, oh, it's a great shopping experience. I come on, I can find what I want and, you know, it goes smoothly. The actual nitty gritty nuance behind the scenes of making that happen, I think is an area that we continue to invest in and uncover great opportunity in. We've talked a bunch about kind of using, 3D and sort of spatial computing as an area that we see as being a real future enhancer to shopping in our category. Today, we do a tremendous amount of actually 2D image rendering. So I think, you know, one of the problems in the 3D space in the future will be content. So if you come onto Wayfair, you're going to say, well, if you can show me products in my room in, you know, a VR environment or an AR environment, that's great and all, but, you know, I want to see everything that you sell, not just these 10 items you happen to have modeled. Well, you know, we're building a huge model library and basically we're doing it because we use those models to do 2D image rendering today. So, you know, we're basically have a great way to fund creating a very large content library that we think then will drive these future experiences. In the meantime, you know, we're really at the forefront of trying to run experiments with all the new AR and VR tools that come out. So, you know, most recently we've talked about the partnership we've had with Magic Leap and using their new device to, you know, really create some cool experiences. I do believe that one of the big anxieties consumers have when they shop this category is it going to look right in my space? You know, will it fit? Will it, you know, come up the stairs cleanly? And some AR, VR stuff we're doing, it's a great solution to, I think, reduce that anxiety. You know, the tools aren't there today. And I think, you know, that some are getting there, but it's a space that, you know, we continue to invest, a tremendous amount into. I think if it's some of the deeper things in our sex, we have an a DevOps team inside Wayfair that, manages all our systems and kind of helps to make sure we can move fast and have velocity in our innovation. I think some of the things that we're doing there that we're contributing back to the open source tech community have been pretty cool. And, you know, we're getting to a size now where we're running a significant scale e-commerce business. We were in this business before cloud existed. And so we've got this pretty, cool environment where we run a lot of stuff ourselves and, you know, we're starting to look like our own cloud services, company, but then we're also using public cloud systems that are available. And so there's a whole, you know, space that I think we're in a unique spot to whatever innovate and take advantage of things in that area. So I know we have a bunch of other kind of things, you know, going on, but hopefully that gives you a feel of a few of them.
Future Commerce is brought to you by PayPal. Did you know cart abandonment is 86% higher on mobile than desktop? PayPal has collaborated with 15 Magento system integrators in high conversion to help close the mobile gap while delivering an improved buying experience. The Mobile E-Commerce Optimization Initiative was formed to understand why the gap in mobile and desktop conversions persist and to provide practical industry insights to help e-commerce providers succeed in mobile sales. Participating merchants can choose from a range of standardized checkout optimization experiments that make sense for their business model. For additional details on how to get involved, the results to date, and testing methodology, visit mobileoptimize.org today.
Future Commerce is brought to you by Vertex. Vertex provides cloud and on-premise solutions that can be tailored to specific industries for every major line of tax, including sales and use, income, value added, and payroll. Vertex Cloud is the SaaS solution that automates sales and use tax, including calculation and returns. With multiple service levels and flexible pricing models, Vertex Cloud meets the sales and use tax needs for businesses of all sizes. From recognizable brands like Honda, Pepsi, Verizon, and small businesses the world over. Find out more today at vertexsmb.com and be sure to mention Future Commerce Podcast to get 15 months for the price of 12. Once again, that's vertexsmb.com. Emarsys is the largest independent marketing platform company in the world. Powered by artificial intelligence, the Emarsys marketing platform enables truly personalized interactions between marketers and customers across all channels, building loyalty, enriching the customer journey, and increasing your revenue. Each day, Emarsys connects more than 2,200 brands with 3.2 billion customers all over the world. Emarsys delivers over 350 million personalized interactions across email, mobile, social, and web. To learn more about how Emarsys can help your company scale marketing decisions and actions, visit emarsys.com/futurecommerce and request your demo today. That's Emarsys, emarsys.com/futurecommerce.
Well, that's kind of just a follow up there. I think the biggest challenge that we face is, you know, top tier retailers and innovators like yourself have very obvious application for some of these types of technologies. Although the way that you described your core customer earlier, I'd love to see her wearing a Magic Leap, but that's secondary. But my understanding is that there are things that there are broader market applications for technology than the ones that we've sort of overlaid into the Minority Report interfaces that we think about when we say AR VR. The 3D modeling as 2D content generation is absolutely the kind of thing that just about anybody as a midsize manufacturer or retailer needs right today anyway, and is probably doing anyway. You're just not orienting your thought around what that. You probably already have assets like this. You're probably already doing this somewhere in your organization. You just haven't thought about what the, you know, what it looks like 5 years or 10 years from now. So I think that's a really salient point. Brian, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, no, it's really exciting to follow up on this because I got to talk to Mike Festa, interview Mike Festa at Shop Talk, and we talked about this a little bit just for a few minutes. And so it's really cool to hear, you know, Steve, you talk about this too. How have you gone about building this? I know, we haven't even said the words Wayfair Next yet, but you've invested heavily internally. Are you investing externally too? Have you made acquisitions? How are you going out, you know, and like finding these tools or building them or thinking about them and what do you see as kind of next steps to continue to push things forward?
Yeah. So, you know, I would say 2.5-3 years ago, I took the lead on kind of running a bunch of experiments internally to sort of see, well, how far is the state of the art of sort of 3D modeling and then 2D image production. And I think very quickly honed in on like, oh my gosh, this feels like a category that's kind of like just crossed the chasm. It's gone from where like, you know, basically you'd have Pixar and some sort of, you know, high-end media shops doing this stuff to where all of a sudden these tools have gotten to where, you know, you find, you know, recent design graduates coming out of school where they're using them and the learning curve's, you know, low enough where all of a sudden, you know, people who are using, you know, who are very good with photography or using cameras can figure out how to use the software. And I think, you know, we sort of recognized that, you know, 2.5-3 years ago. And then right away you're sort of like faced with, okay, well, you know, can we go out and hire a company to do this for us? And there's very, you know, there's basically no one in the landscape that we could come across that's at scale that's doing you know, high level, you know, modeling and 2D rendering. There are a few and they exist, but nobody's doing it at real scale. So then, you know, we're so confident, I guess, in our execution abilities, and we've built so many systems that drive process and that, you know, create assets and deliver experiences. We quickly say, well, you know, this is a landscape where the demand we're going to have is going to far outpace the capacity of, you know, the people with the talent in the world. We need to figure out how to drive talent creation in this space. And so, we started off internally, just, you know, bringing on people to the team. We run an internal labs program for 3D artists. So we trained a lot of 3D artists in kind of, you know, the tools and techniques that we use to generate the stuff we do. We then quickly sort of realized, like, geez, even at this, we're not going to be able to keep up the scale we need. We really need to educate the whole industry, and we need thousands of people doing this content creation in parallel in order for this to really take off. And so we actually publicly published a thing we call 3D University, which, if you go to tech.wayfair.com, it's on our blog. You know, we in excruciating detail, like, I'm pretty confident if you've never modeled in your life, you could come on, spend a few weeks on our going through our program. And at the end of it, you know, you'd be someone who's pretty functional and, you know, pretty skilled in the particular, you know, whatever, this particular area. And so, you know, that's been a great example of something we've kind of open sourced to the broader community to say, hey, look, you know, the ability to create content is going to be the thing that's really going to drive adoption of 3D. And, you know, while we're going to continue to drive it, and we have a lot of systems internally ourselves that, you know, we're building out, we need a broader set of the industry to drive it. I was telling someone recently, actually, I think it's going to be fun 5 years from now. I think we have one of the largest 3D modeling artist teams in the country I'm aware of. And, you know, it'll create this funny concentration of that talent in this market in Boston, which will be fun to see, you know, 5 years from now, what that seeds and what some of the team ends up going on to do. Because, you know, I'm sure a lot of them will stay with us, but they'll do some new things because it's such an evolving space.
I love this so much.
that was a comprehensive answer. Thank you.
I have to think, like, you know, you've seen so much success the past few years, and, you know, so would you, I mean, you've put a lot into being that successful, but would you consider Wayfair Next sort of key to your success going forward? And, you know, what level of importance do you put on this kind of culture?
Well, so, you know, Wayfair Next is just it's a small team that really has driven the AR/VR research inside Wayfair. I think, you know, when you think about innovation, you need that across the entire organization. And so I think, you know, if you went and saw what we're doing in transportation, shipping logistics, we're doing some equally, you know, I think they're probably more impactful to our customer in the next 2 years.
Wait, tell us about this.
Well, so I think, you know, if you think about home, a lot of the products we sell are quite large. I think our average parcel is 30 pounds. You know, that compares to the small parcel guys, or a lot of the mass market guys are in the single, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 pounds. A lot of things we sell there are 100 pound plus, and FedEx, UPS don't carry them. If you think about, you know, historically home purchasing, I think one of the big anxieties is, you know, how do I get this to my house? Is it going to ship? Is it going to be some, you know, surly trucker shows up and it's kind of like telling me I got to come get it off the truck. And, you know, I guess take a day off work because, you know, they're giving me a window. That's the whole day. That's a terrible experience. And we just over the last year or two here, we've talked about this thing we call the Wayfair Delivery Network, but we are basically building out a national footprint of distribution agents where we control the whole flow of the freight and we control all the scheduling. And so we can deliver an experience where day of delivery, you can track the truck coming to your door. And, you know, you see that a little bit with, you know, FedEx, UPS and small parcel guys have done it. Nobody's doing it in large parcel freight side. And so, you know, we believe that's going to be a highly impactful experience to our customers. And it's a very complicated tech problem because you're moving around, you know, huge, big products that, you know, you got to be careful about how, you know, not getting them damaged. You're trying to schedule things that are, you know, several, you know, often several days out. And then you're trying to deliver an experience day of delivery where, you know, the customers feel very great about, you know, the delivery team that comes out and brings it to them. So it's an interesting coupling of physical assets with sort of technology innovation.
I have to remark that we've come sort of full circle in that this was the only way of doing this, you know, 50 years ago. that there was no such thing as like you had to have your own sort of last mile delivery focus, like and a lot of that was built around accessibility to your catalog in store. Sears, I mean, one of those things that we had, you know, a challenge around early on in telling retailers or telling small or SMB retailers that they could do digital was how they would solve shipping and logistics. It's so interesting that with dominance of players like, you know, Amazon in the space, that we forget that we used to do it a different way, that your relationship, that the owning of the experience with the customer was integral from the order placement to the order delivery. Yeah. And understanding that relationship, right? You wouldn't have outsourced that relationship 50 years ago, but that's sort of the norm now. It's kind of interesting that we come full circle to come back to that.
Yeah, well, it definitely is. I mean, I think, you know, I always tell the team here that it is very easy to throw up a sexy website where everything's in stock and everything ships in 24 hours. Like, you know, literally I could put up a site tomorrow that sells whatever you want. It is very hard to durably make that happen over time.
Sure.
And, you know, knitting that together with the physical execution of it is that's the complexity in retail and in commerce. And if you want a great experience for the customer, you do need to own it soup to nuts. And there are definitely parts of the stack where you can use great, you know, partners that you work with. And there are other parts of the stack where the partners don't exist and you need to go out and figure out how to innovate those on your own.
We have I have a saying that there's this sort of like, it's Moore's law, but for marketplaces, and that they eventually become payment platform, shipping platform, cloud computing platform, AR, VR. They just become you are a platform company, so you understand things as a platform challenge to solve.
For sure, yeah.
Right. It's super interesting.
I mean, one thing that I've heard right here is for merchants out there, like, there's a big question: when do you build, when do you buy? You know, what parts of the customer experience do you own? Which do you outsource? And, you know, a lot of these technologies that you've invested in internally and have taken ownership of have provided you with an edge. But what about, you know, third-party sellers and customers that you have? Do you see, you know, what you're doing? Obviously, in the 3D space, you're passing on a lot of value to them. But you see, you know, where do you see other merchants that maybe kind of feed into your marketplace? What pieces should they take on themselves? What should they pull from you? What should they pull from others? You know, give a little advice there.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I think the category is pretty cool in that we buy from 10,000 plus suppliers, and, you know, they're all entrepreneurs. And so, you know, they are running, you know, their businesses and, you know, they're going after different opportunities they see. I think the thing that, we try to, you know, partner with our suppliers to say is, hey, look, suppliers in our category, they need to be great at figuring out, you know, how to, you know, figure out what styles are going to be good, how to do value manufacturing, how to make sure things are being produced in a quality way and responsibly. And, you know, they really are, we are trying to enable them to bring their product visions to, you know, the consumer. So we run this platform that they can use to basically enhance their businesses, right? So they can come onto the Wayfair platform. They can use our tools to understand, you know, different price bands of what products are selling and what areas, and, you know, what are we seeing for traffic and what are we seeing for interest areas from customers. And they can understand, you know, what we think demand forecast and what we think inventory planning might look like, and, you know, for products that they're launching on our platform. They can, you know, spend, you know, on sponsored SKUs. They can use that as a way to sort of test the waters. And if they have a new introduction to market that they're excited about and they're not quite sure what the volumes would look like, they can launch it on our platform. They can, you know, get it sponsored to give it visibility. They can sort of get a good quick read on what the popularity of it might be. And then, you know, we'll give them insights into what we think as well that they can then drive into kind of their demand forecasting. So, yeah, I think, this space is very cool because I think, you know, every year we see, you know, dozens if not hundreds of new entrepreneurs show up who have a great design product idea, and, you know, they're using a platform like Wayfair to bring their products to light in front of the customer, and we can drive traffic and we can create awareness and we can create visibility for them in a way that they struggle to do on their own, and, you know, frankly, they're better off using a platform like ours to do it through.
One thing that I think that people forget is that that relationship is supposed to be assistive and supportive. You're not just you're not just a place for people to make products and then sell them. You're not just a sales channel. Ideally, the value that you're providing to them is not just access to a customer base, but also the benefit to have that backflow of data to help inform their decisions of product assortment. And like that was the supposed benefit of marketplaces, was that we have a larger, we have the insight into the customer, and we'll help you, be better at manufacturing the product to reach the customer. What do you think of that?
Yeah. So I think, that's right. I think, you know, historically retail had a much more combative relationship with their supply chain. Yep. And it was, you know, a merchant would go out, they'd pick products they thought were going to be the hot sellers for that year. And they would just, you know, they would just try to crush the supply chain as much as they could to figure out who could supply that particular item at the cheapest price possible. I think when you look at the, you know, platform like Wayfair or other online platforms, we basically say, hey, look, if you think you've created great value in the market, put it up, you know, put it up, and the guys you're competing with are the other people who are trying to, you know, go against the similar value to what you're creating. So you're not really competing with us, you know, as a platform. You're competing with the landscape of the other guys in the industry. And so I think it changes the dynamic somewhat. Obviously, you know, there's always competition in the world, and you're always going to have someone who said, if they see a similar opportunity, is going to go out and say, all right, I think I can do it a little bit better. But it creates a much healthier dynamic for, you know, for the relationships with retailers or their suppliers. And we've certainly tried to become, you know, think about it as, hey, how do we make our suppliers as successful as they can be? How do we give them the tools they need to be as competitive as they can be with, you know, everyone else that they see, you know, opportunity to go against in the industry?
That's the promise, right? This is always the challenge. Is as a manufacturer, you have this temptation to want to go direct to your consumer, thinking that, you know, you look at your marketplace channel as like a cost center, or it's not your true consumer. That there's another consumer out there who's looking to buy. I can't believe that there are that there is a market for, you know, 300 direct-to-consumer manufacturers of the same style of couch. They're all competing for the same traffic. They're all competing. Like, there are some categories that will really only thrive in marketplace. So you have to have a value add that keeps them from, you know, that resists the temptation, or keeps them from creating a category like custom bespoke furniture that only, you know, they could deliver direct-to-consumer. And that's itself its own challenge. So I see that a lot. And Brian and I see that a lot. It's a constant conversation, especially when you have marketplaces that turn around and then compete directly with those partnerships. it's really tough to continue to preach the value of that marketplace. But
I want to get back to something. go ahead. I'll let you finish that out.
I think that's a very topical. But go ahead, Brian.
This relates back to something that I kind of cut you off on. I think a little bit earlier when I asked you to talk about what you were doing in logistics. But how is the, you know, your culture of innovation and empowering your merchants, how is that helping you compete in what is now a very like crowded marketplace landscape, with, you know, Walmart's marketplace coming on and a whole host of other marketplaces that didn't exist back when you started Wayfair?
Yeah, well, so, you know, I would absolutely tell you that, like, having, I think if you talk to suppliers in our space, you know, they almost universally would tell you they love working with Wayfair, and that they honestly feel like we are a partner to them, and that we are actually trying to, you know, help them with their businesses. I think, you sort of alluded to it, but I think that historic retail, then even you see this in some of the more, you know, again, commodity stuff, where if you're selling paper towels, you're selling batteries, you're selling, you know, soaps and razors. There is definitely an appeal as a retailer to say, oh, let me go figure out how I can take my first cost lower and how I can go deeper into the manufacturing chain so that I can, you know, buy better and I can offer a product to the consumer that, you know, my belief is that they're interchangeable. And so I can push the consumer in different ways. And as soon as you start going in that direction as a retail, obviously you're now a competitor directly with your supply chain. And, you know, I guess I look at it as like, look, would I rather have 10,000 entrepreneurs who are like super excited about me innovating every day and trying to be successful on their own? Or would I rather go against that, you know, that team and try to do it, you know, go deep and try to beat the ones here and there. If you find one who's having success, you know, you kind of beat them down and go after this particular market. Like, that's just tough dynamic that I don't, you know, our belief is that you're better off trying to create an environment where you are, you know, you're not going in and trying to say, hey, we're just going to steal the top sellers and go deep on them, but that we're going to try to create a platform where, you know, everyone can have a successful business, or, you know, they're competing with their other people in the space and not competing with a guy who's got an unfair sort of, you know, insight into data on them.
So that culture and mindset is something that would appeal to merchants that are well beyond the home category. Do you see yourself kind of pushing into other categories and taking this further? I mean, the culture of innovation you have is you know, it's best in class. And I would imagine that there are a lot of other categories that would love to come into an environment where they're being empowered and you're having that tech flow back to them and everything that you're doing, on the innovation side, sort of filtered down into their categories as well. Do you see that happening, or?
You know, unlikely that we are really focused on just providing the best experience in this home category. I think, you know, we will continue to add tools and enhancements to our platform that let our vendor community and you know, our customers have, you know, more and more, you know, whatever, less friction in kind of their running their businesses. And so, you know, I think if you look out over the next several years, I think, you know, really the focus is how do we continue to, you know, just crush it in home, provide a great experience for customers. And then, you know, I think there probably are seeds that have been planted inside the company today where you look and say, oh yeah, you guys are actually, you know, you're running a kind of a software platform now for your suppliers. And, you know, that's kind of an interesting sort of, you know, thing I hadn't really thought much about, but you've kind of evolved into that space now. And, you know, I think that there will be things that we, you know, sort of continue to evolve toward, but I don't know that, you know, trying to be something that we aren't outside of home is really, you know, a direction we're going to go.
Yeah. Amazon only sells books, right? That's what they do. They, 5 years from now, when you're doing subscription fashion boxes, I'll remind you of this conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, they sort of were always, well, maybe they were, they seemed to, yeah, maybe they rewrite.
Yeah, no, I'm just
always taking shots. The everything store, but.
What I think is really interesting too, though, is this idea that, see, everyone probably thought I was taking shots at that company this whole time. I'm really talking about Target. Who seems to, you know, is having trouble, you know, retaining a millennial customer. I think as generation changes and as tastes change, you know, you have to adapt your strategy, and, you know, what used to work 5 years ago doesn't work now. And so you have to constantly evolve and aim to where you're going. And I think that's kind of the crux here. We would also, by the way, I really appreciate all the time in the conversation. We would be remiss if we didn't at least mention Wayfair has been in the news a lot, especially around the landmark South Dakota versus Wayfair decision, which I think, you know, a lot of retailers have their eyes on in digital commerce. But more broadly speaking, not to address that directly, there's a lot of implications right now in public policy and how retailers are having to shift their business strategies, everything from, you know, from net neutrality, as we've talked about a lot on the show, to tariffs, to privacy and GDPR and data privacy. Those are all things that are, you know, super top of mind and very topical. How does Wayfair see, you know, public policy and global policy shift sort of affecting how your strategy is determined as a business?
Yeah, I would say broadly, I think of that realm of stuff as, you know, we have a team that does, I would say, they tend to do well with change and complexity. And so, you know, all the things you just mentioned basically sort of play to that, right? Where if things are changing or it's adding complexity, it's adding steps, it's adding, you know, you have to change the nuance of how you're doing things. It tends to play to our strength. I mean, we have a very innovative culture who's, you know, loves diving in and trying to figure out how do we navigate the next challenge that's kind of coming at us. And so, yeah, I think our ability to do that is one of the reasons we've been successful, and that kind of compounds over time. So with an immediate sort of one thing, so tariffs, you know, everyone in the industry is going to be thinking about that and trying to figure out how to navigate that. Well, sure. You know, can we figure out how to navigate that just, you know, a day or two quicker than everybody else? And can we figure out how to, you know, figure out a couple ways to you know, work that to our advantage? So, you know, broadly, I think of that sort of spectrum of things kind of falling in. And there are things that are out of your control. So there's a little bit of like, the best thing you can do is have a team that can react quickly and know how to respond to change.
Oh, that's awesome.
Smart. I like that a lot. And I think that, you know, I could see a lot of other businesses, if they aren't already doing that, having that sort of team that's focused on that, I think that's a takeaway as well. One more kind of off the cuff question here. I heard a rumor that you are going to be piloting some pop up shops, maybe.
Yeah.
And so I'd love to hear you kind of talk about what you're doing there, what you hope to take away, and what you learned from that. The whole clicks to bricks, bricks to clicks, you know, the digital natives moving to brick and mortar, omnichannel, yeah, thing is such a big topic right now. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as we kind of finish out the interview.
Yeah, you know, obviously all the bricks and mortar guys are trying to figure out how to mix the two channels. We're doing two pop-up shops. We've talked about one in New Jersey, one up near us here in outside of Boston, this holiday season. And, you know, they're experiments for us. I mean, we're obviously, you know, we've been maniacally focused on how you provide the best online and shopping experience that we can. And, you know, I think there's a curiosity around, hey, is there, you know, a whole meadow out there that we haven't sort of thought about harvesting yet are there opportunities to get in front of customers in the physical world that would be additive to our overall, experience. And so, you know, those would be, you know, informative for us. And, you know, I'm looking forward to going out and actually sort of, mystery shopping the one we have near us here in Boston and seeing what customers that are going through it actually are, you know, what they're thinking and how they're behaving.
That's awesome.
It's really interesting. So as we close up, so, if you had to give some, you know, near-term recommendations for, retailers in the space based on what you've learned, over the past, you know, couple decades, what would you say? How about this? What would you tell Steve 10 years ago?
Keep focusing on execution. You know, it's almost always better to try what you think might be a good idea rather than sort of just speculate about it. You know, I think it's probably as simple as that. You know, there are definitely things I look back at and say like, oh, well, rather than argue or discuss that, we could have spent, you know, half the time or whatever, you know, a small amount of time and just answered it. You know, it's a little bit of like the old, you know, thing about like, you know, if two of us are in a room together and we're arguing about the height of the ceiling and, you know, well, we happen to know the third guy's got a yardstick with him, like, just get the yardstick out and stop arguing. You know, I think just watch out for that pattern and, you know, keep moving and keep innovating.
Really good advice. I love that. That makes me really happy because that's what we try to do at Future Commerce. What about 5 years from now? What do you see ahead? What would you say? Just a couple. What's one technology or thing that retailers should keep their eye on ahead? Really, really broad question, but.
Oh boy. Quantum computing. everyone talks about it, but I do think that the sort of big data AI world is, it's an area that if you're not focused on it and have a team and investing in it, that you're going to feel like you missed the boat 5 years from now. And that it's going to, you know, it will be hard to compete with companies who have very tuned automated machines that are using, you know, a high degree of computational power to figure things out. It's been interesting in that space. You know, we have some pretty complicated models and they get to the point where it's really hard to understand oftentimes why they're making a certain decision. So actually building in the tools to have the insight into how decisions are made into your AI and platforms has been very informative for us on the one side to say, okay, yeah, now I believe that the decision is the right decision. But it also just illustrates that as these things get more complex, they will be harder and harder to compete with, I think, unless you are also investing in them. So
good advice. Good place to end it.
I might leave you there.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Steve. It's been such a fun interview. I've really enjoyed talking with you. We're looking forward to seeing what's ahead for Wayfair, and we'll have to check back in with you from time to time. Looking forward to those Q3 numbers as well. And so I really appreciate your time on the show, and I know that our merchant listeners do as well. Philip, you want to take us home?
Yeah, thanks for listening. You can always give your feedback and lend your voice to this conversation over at futurecommerce.fm, and we really want to hear back from you. You can also get this podcast anywhere podcast or consumer on any smart speaker device with the phrase "Play Future Commerce." And as we always say,
retail tech is moving fast
and future commerce is moving faster. Thanks again, Steve.
Thanks, guys.